Good afternoon, everyone. I am calling to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the first order of business, which I forgot yesterday, is to call the roll. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please call the roll.
I will. Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher. Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grünhagen.
Present.
Keel. Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor. Kwong.
Yes.
Oh, Pryor?
Pryor, present.
Okay, gotcha. Kwong. Ryer. Schultz.
Schultz, present.
Wolgemuth.
Present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. And just so members are aware, as you come in, she makes note of your presence and we'll get you. We're not going to penalize anybody because they weren't here at the very moment when the roll was called. So, okay. So today on the agenda, we have and I'm told that Representative Schumacher is here, so we'll note his presence on the roll. So with a quorum present, we will move on to approval of the minutes of yesterday, February 7th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam, so moved.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes of February 7th, 2022. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, so the first thing that we are going to hear today is a presentation from Commissioner Harpstead about the healthcare workforce, which is, as we all know, is a really critical issue. And appreciate her taking time to come and give us a presentation today. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. We've got a slide presentation we're going to put up here. Thank you very much. I've come to call this the caring professions. First of all, I want to start out with this slide from the state demographer. You can see from the first four bars in the bar chart that through 2015, you can see the Minnesota's labor force growth. And then you can see what happens to it for the next several decades. So it's pretty self-evident. Of course, we've all known this was coming for a very long time. But COVID and the Great Resignation really amped it up, and it's hard to miss now when you take a look at what's happening in our workforce. Next slide. So the caring professions, just to be sure that we're covering all of it and not getting five or six presentations from different sectors, are all those frontline workers we applauded throughout the pandemic. Nursing homes, assisted living, group homes for people with disabilities, behavioral health services, home-based care services, childcare, and healthcare. Together, they represent 15% of the entire Minnesota workforce, which is a higher percent than some other states. DHS likes to say in our literature that we support 1.7 million Minnesotans in some way every year, which would mean that 15% of the Minnesota workforce serves at least 30% of the Minnesota population in some way. Next slide. The average wage in the caring professions is about 30% below the average Minnesota wage. While the average Minnesota wage has risen 4.3% over the past year as employers compete for workers. While all of Minnesota will suffer from a workforce shortage over the next four decades, the prevailing wage in this sector makes it particularly vulnerable. This is also an equity issue. We pulled a couple of particular workforce categories from DEED, our colleagues at DEED, and we understand that 46% of nursing assistants and 19% of childcare workers are BIPOC. 87% of nursing assistants and 95% of childcare workers are female. 27% of our nursing assistants and 19% of our childcare workers, probably because their wage is 30% below the average Minnesota wage, are also on medical assistance benefits. And our 21% of our nursing assistants and 7% of our childcare workers are also receiving SNAP food benefits. Next slide. When I think about the sources of funding for the caring professions, because hospitals and healthcare in general is so highly paid for by Medicare and Medicaid, you could say that 46% of the support for their employee base is paid for by government, and 32% of nonprofit providers' overall budgets are paid for by government. So the responsibility for the vitality of the caring profession sector rests with state and federal government, or you could say all taxpayers, and certainly this sector is a public responsibility. Unlike some of the workforce shortages you hear about, there, where private businesses will have to deal with them in some way by changing their business models or consolidating or raising prices, this sector is a public responsibility. Next slide. It is also true that the white American post-World War II population was the first in the history of the planet to send its elders, people with disabilities, and family members with behavioral health issues to live with 24/7 staff because it could afford to for the first time in the history of the planet. Even if we could afford it going forward, you can see that it'll be very hard to staff 24/7 congregate care for so much of our population any more than other countries can. Certainly developments like Amazon, grocery and pharma delivery, Uber transportation, make it more and more possible for people to remain in their own homes for as long as they need or want to. So that is a bright spot and one of the things that amped up during the COVID pandemic. Next slide. So we will need new models. There's no question about that. And the independence package that passed in the last session with the HHS bill to support home care, for example, the PCA industry as part of that and other home care services, was the sort of investment that we need for sure. Still, it will take some years for new models to be established, and this sector will need a smooth ramp down from what it has been, not a cliff. A recent McKinsey report reviewed by the Council on Economic Expansion said that as automation and home delivery reduce the need for retail sales, administrative, and production jobs, the fastest growing sector will be the caring professions with their required social skills that cannot be automated. Next slide. This just shows you from a recent DEED job vacancy survey finding from the second quarter of 2021. You can see the teal blue wedge at the top right of the circle, the vacancies in the healthcare and social assistance sectors, topped only by, it's the largest number. The second and third are accommodation, food services, and then retail trade. Next slide. So I do want to acknowledge recent good decisions in this area. First of all, bills that passed in the 21 session, key provisions, the PCA rate framework that I mentioned earlier, the CCAP rate increase that helps to pay for childcare workers. There was a passage of a bill for an early DWRS rate increase for services for people with developmental disabilities. The HCBS workforce development grants passed in the last session and provider capacity grants for underserved communities. Quite an investment last year. Next slide. In between sessions and throughout the pandemic, there have been many investments made by the governor's office and various federal resources. This whole slide is for nursing facilities, staffing for four hospital decompression sites through MDH, waiving nursing facilities repayment of the federal grants and loans they received in 2020, nursing facility emergency grants for additional staffing by DHS, emergency 12A10 Medicaid funding for nursing facilities, and a temporary interim Medicaid payment rate in the beginning of January while we were waiting to work out the 2022 rates for nursing homes gave them an early payment, not a larger one, but at least the cash earlier. And then governor and federal resources we've been able to make available to other providers include a temporary emergency staffing pool, which was a COVID response run by DHS, primarily for group homes for people with disabilities and assisted living facilities. The second of the emergency staffing pool, hospital supplemental staffing run by MDH out of ARPA funds and with a hospital cost share of private money. And then emergency funding also through the 12A10 emergency staffing, emergency authorities that we have to address staffing shortages in group homes and services provided in a recipient's home, which will begin to flow in April. And so you can see those dollars, $250,000 dollars throughout the last couple of years. And finally, key provisions in the governor's proposal that has just been released impacting the caring professions include a $115 million caring professions proposal of incentives for hiring and retention for the DHS licensed caring professions in behavioral health, people with disabilities, assisted living, and home health care, or not home health care, sorry, home services like PCA. And then the healthcare workforce revitalization bill, and then a couple of major investments in childcare, including increasing the CCAP rate once again, and the childcare stabilization supports to support the childcare industry. And that is my presentation, and eager to answer your questions and continue this dialogue as we talk together throughout the session about the very best way to support these precious caring professions as we go into this continued workforce shortage in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, for that. And you know, it's a rare moment when we actually have some time for questions. If members do have questions or want to have a little bit of discussion, we have another presentation coming. And also, I had Diane Rydrick on my list here. I don't know if she was just there for, if she had something separate to present. I'm not really sure. Maybe she did. But were there any questions for the commissioner? All right, not seeing any. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Ms. Rydrick, are you here and do you have a separate presentation?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I am and I do.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, so Lisa, good. Are you able to pull up the slides? Let's see if I can see what you see. Okay, great. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner of the Health Systems Bureau here at MDH, and very pleased to be here to talk with you today, and pleased to be able to follow Commissioner Harpstead, too, because she really, I think, laid the groundwork for some of the things that we want to talk about. So next slide, Lisa. And we, too, are fans of DEED's job vacancy survey, and so we're going to include just one slide here from the vacancy survey because I think it's really important context. And I wanted to lay this groundwork before I jump into talking about some of the emergency supports that we've been providing and a quick overview of our budget proposal.
And Ms. Rydrick, before you go any further, Lisa, if you could kind of reset the display here because it's... it might be the display. There we go. Excellent. Okay. Now Great. We can all see it clearly. Please continue.
Yeah. So I just wanted to show one slide that gives you, I think, a good perspective on the impact of the pandemic on vacancies in healthcare. And Commissioner Harpstead highlighted this job vacancy survey from DEED in a different way, looking at the overall number of vacancies that we see in a recent quarter in 2021. But we wanted to look at this across time and look at how vacancies have been changing for some of the healthcare related roles specifically. And if you look at the blue line here, this is healthcare practitioner and technical occupations, which are, you know, physicians, RNs, LPNs, pharmacists, PAs, therapists, et cetera. And the green line is the support occupations, which is where you'd find home health aides and PCAs and nursing assistants or CNAs and pharmacy aides, et cetera. And you see a significant jump between 2019 and 2021 in the vacancy rate, especially for the practitioners and technical professions, catching up largely to where the healthcare support occupations have been for a couple of years. And that is, you know, it's the contribution of retirement, it's attrition, it's burnout, it's all of those things that have been contributing to what the healthcare industry is going through right now, which is, you know, they're coming out hopefully soon of 2 years of really unprecedented strain. And I think that's why you see some of the really large scale initiatives that the administration and MDH and DHS have put forward over the last couple of years. We are finalizing a more comprehensive report on the pandemic impact on the healthcare workforce and collaborating with DEED on that. And we would love to come back and provide an overview of those findings, which we should have soon. I think it would be really important for you to see some of that impact of the pandemic and what it means for our projections of the healthcare workforce going forward, as you are considering a number of workforce proposals going forward. So, Lisa, next slide. So I want to give you a quick update on a couple of the emergency initiatives that Commissioner Harpstead noted that we have put forward in the last couple of months. And the first is the emergency hospital staffing pool that the commissioner mentioned, which is a $40 million initiative that has just come about in the last couple of months. And this really grew out of what we were seeing as we were starting that rise at the beginning of the Omicron surge, right around the holidays, when we were looking at some of the northeastern states and Europe and South Africa, and the surge that they were seeing, not just in overall cases, but in hospitalizations. And really significantly, the strain that was happening to the hospitals and healthcare systems because of the really high number of their staff who were out related to Omicron from their own positive test or exposure, or because a family member had tested positive. At that time in December and throughout January, we were hearing from the healthcare delivery system of extremely high numbers of staff being out with COVID, as much as 15 or 20% of the nursing workforce at any one time. And so, again, that's coming on top of a two-year period of really unprecedented strain. So the state took very rapid action to provide emergency staffing support to hospitals through a contract with a staffing vendor. The contract got executed within about a week, which was a gear that I didn't even think existed, even after 2 years of this. And the contract provides a total of about 330 FTEs, 220 or 219 people working 60 hours a week for 60 days and going to hospitals around the state. Nearly all of them are med-surg or ICU nurses, and just a couple of respiratory therapists at this point. And they are on the ground, 140 of them so far are on the ground providing care in hospitals around the state. The hospitals that are receiving that support are covering 25% of the cost themselves for this staff, and the rest is funded through ARPA funds after we received LCRC approval in January. And Lisa, if you could go to the next slide. So the next slide just shows you really quickly where these providers are going around the state. So we have worked very closely with the regional healthcare preparedness coordinators around the state for the eight regions of the state. And they in turn have worked with their hospitals to identify which ones should get a team. It's likely that when all is said and done, we'll have probably just 30 or 40 hospitals around the state who will receive staff. And that's because we wanted to not do, you know, one nurse here and one nurse there, but to really have enough people there that it could make a difference for them. For some smaller hospitals, that's still just two or three nurses. And for the larger metro hospitals, that might be 10 to 15, I think up to 17 or so staff at one hospital. But it's been a really great way to work with our regional coalitions and with the hospitals to make sure that we've got a good statewide approach to this. And we're really putting those resources where there is the most need. You could go to the next slide. So the other initiative that Commissioner Harpstead mentioned briefly is the hospital decompression initiative, which started back at the beginning of November. And I think sometimes the name gets confusing with this one. It's about providing pressure relief or decompression to hospitals through supporting nursing homes. So we have been providing staffing to four, now five nursing homes in different parts of the state. There's one in Shakopee, Hastings, Brainerd, and now two in St. Paul, so that they can make more beds available for patients who no longer need hospital level care, but are not yet at a place where they can go home. And this really came from messages that we were hearing from hospital leaders around the state saying that, you know, at a time when they're kind of bursting at the seams in terms of their daily census, they had patients who didn't need to be there anymore and who, if they could find a post-acute placement, would make space in a bed for someone else who does need that hospital level of care. The approach we've taken with this, again, is a regional approach and working with the health systems to make sure that they've got a decompression site in their region that they can refer to and sort of an orderly process for referring. And private vendors provide the staff for these sites, RNs and CNAs. At the initial stages of the program, there were National Guard soldiers who were providing CNA or temporary nursing assistant support at four of the sites. And now the National Guard has left those four, but they are staffing a small four-week site at a skilled nursing facility that's located within the region's hospital campus. So that one is National Guard only. The rest are now vendor only. And they're focusing on lower acuity patients. So that means someone who might be post a hip surgery or a knee surgery, or someone who has pneumonia, but not ventilated patients, not the really complex behavioral health needs, not the really complex dementia care patients, so kind of lower to medium acuity. We'll be continuing to support these sites over the next couple months, and we're trying to stay closely connected to the metrics of demand, both how many people we see waiting in the ED for a bed on the hospital side, and how many nursing homes are getting to a point where they are able to accept admissions again, because that's the other side of the equation is if they are having severe staffing concerns on the nursing home side and can't accept new admissions, then that's where we get that bottleneck. We're also working with the sites to see if we can get to a place where they can support some higher acuity patients for the remainder of the program, because I do think that's an evolving need for hospitals. And we're exploring whether we can provide some of this care, not at a brick and mortar nursing home, but through home care support, kind of a virtual decompression site model. If you want to go to the next slide, Lisa, I think this is the last one on our emergency efforts, and just wanted to highlight other initiatives that have been in place to provide support for healthcare staffing on both the hospital and long-term care sides over the last few months. As you know, there have been four Department of Defense emergency medical teams that have provided staff at HCMC, Fairview Southdale, Abbott, Northwestern, and St. Cloud hospitals. The only one that is still in place right now is Abbott Northwestern, and they just started last week, and the team will be in place there through the very, very beginning of March. And those are 23 to 25 member teams from various branches of the military, usually four physicians, 10 to 12 nurses, respiratory therapists, others. And they provide support for between 15 days for Fairview Southdale and 60 days for St. Cloud and HCMC. We also have been working with the National Guard to provide support to nursing homes that are in crisis for the last several months since around Thanksgiving. We've had National Guard members who provide crisis staffing support as a team to nursing homes that are experiencing severe staffing crises. They go out for 2 to 3 week rotations in those nursing homes, usually in teams of 10, but sometimes as large as 20 or 30. And since that point, when we began that program in November, they have provided crisis staffing support to more than 40 nursing homes. The map here on the right shows you the counties and the number of nursing homes in each county that have requested a team. They haven't all received one because sometimes they're able to work through their staffing crisis on their own. But it gives you a good sense of the need around the state. We've been having community meetings in all of these counties to help them understand what some of the challenges are for staffing and long-term care, and to really encourage them to think about how they can partner with facilities, how they can support the Office of Higher Ed's CNA initiative to really pair students to those facilities. And then finally, we've put in place some regulatory relief around hospital and nursing home beds to allow additional flexibility to providers to add beds where needed if they have the staff to care for them. Next slide. Just a few more from me. So I know that we will have other opportunities to come here to this committee and talk about workforce-related proposals that are in the governor's office budget, but we wanted to provide just a really high-level overview here I don't think I have to say too much about why we think it's important to make some investments in the healthcare workforce this session. We know that labor shortages in the healthcare sector have really been exacerbated by COVID. It has stressed an already fragile care delivery system, but it has also stressed the clinical training infrastructure that we have in the state. The pandemic has made it more difficult for people to get training. And that leads to some challenges in terms of the level of preparedness that people have when they go to practice. It's also made it difficult for preceptors to take on students, especially in rural areas, and has just given us, I think, a wake-up call about the need for a better understanding of some of the workforce dynamics and how we can better recruit and retain people, especially in rural areas and in communities that are disproportionately impacted by health disparities. So we are looking at a package that includes a number of initiatives that address different critical issues along the training and practice continuum of the workforce pipeline. We're focused on bringing more qualified and prepared healthcare providers to the field, including rural family medicine physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and others, and increasing the number of rural providers and providers from BIPOC and underrepresented communities to improve access to care. So we would be looking at proposals that are related to developing rural training tracks for family medicine physicians, NPs, PAs, and dental providers in rural areas, increasing the funding for the international IMG or immigrant medical graduate training program so that we're giving those individuals who are already trained and ready in most cases to really be providing care so that we're creating more opportunities for them. And one more slide from me before I transition to Chelsea for a couple of slides. We're also looking at how we can expand clinical training opportunities for sites that don't benefit from the MERC program right now, given the way that that funding formula works, providing funding for mental health occupation training, including a key pain point that we've heard from the mental health community, which is the need to cover supervision costs associated with licensure, and then funding additional workforce research to build an evidence base for data-driven solutions. And we have just another slide or two. I'm going to turn it over to Chelsea Huntley, who directs our community health division, who can speak to the local public health aspects of this work, which I think are often overlooked when we talk about the caring professions.
Great, thank you.
Okay,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, welcome. Let me just say, I do have a number of members with your hands up, but I think we'll go through the rest of the presentation and then we'll go to member questions. So welcome to the committee, please introduce yourself.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, happy to be here this afternoon. For the record, my name is Chelsea Huntley and I direct the Community Health Division at MDH. And I'm really pleased to be here today to talk, as Diane said, about our public health workforce trends. So these are the folks that are working in local, tribal, or state health departments, really at that community level. So where healthcare is working with individuals, we have public health workers across the state who are working with communities to prevent and control diseases, address issues, and try to prevent things from happening. And in terms of their workforce trends, really pre-pandemic, that workforce was getting smaller. In Minnesota, there was about a 12% decrease in staffing in our local health departments from about 2007 on. Very similar at the national level, where they're looking at all state and local health departments, seeing about a 15% decrease in staffing related to funding and other issues. And really over time, a need for new skill sets. While there might have been a time where most health departments had folks who were really providing care to individuals, we now need folks who, as we saw through the pandemic, are really savvy in taking in information and communicating it to the public in a way that it can be understood, in working with businesses and schools and others. So just a need for a broader skill set in those health departments. Definitely a need to increase racial and ethnic diversity. Here in Minnesota, 87% of our local public health workforce is white, whereas in the general population, 79% of individuals are white. Similar to healthcare, high stress and burnout is absolutely a factor in health departments. We've seen not only early retirements, but a number of resignations for local health leaders. And a survey done nationally in the spring of 2021, earlier in the pandemic, 52.8% of public health workers reported symptoms of anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or suicidal ideation. So the field is really, really suffering. And as with everyone else, we're competing with other sectors to fill vacancies, but really especially challenging, we hear from our colleagues in Greater Minnesota. Next slide, please, Lisa. So governor's supplemental budget recommendations really have three tools for attracting and retaining a committed, diverse, and talented public health workforce. We're looking to expand the existing loan forgiveness program to those working in local, tribal, and state health agencies. So really specific to those folks working in governmental public health. We'd like to support a new Public Health AmeriCorps program to get folks from community into governmental public health, and the support being asked for is to increase the stipend to be a more equitable to a living wage. And then for some educational stipends so we can get students from across the state interested in doing their on-site activities in a governmental public health department. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Very interesting. I mean, the focus on stipends, I think, is especially notable because sometimes we think that just because we reduce the cost of an educational experience for people that they can take advantage of it. It's not always the case. If they have a family, they need to be earning money while they study, et cetera. Doing some stipends are a really good tool. So we have, okay, so we have Representative Hewitt, then Grunhagen, then Pryor. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more to the Department of Health. Recently, I've been looking at this real closely for EMTs, but I'm wondering why the state has not really jumped on this and looked at those entry-level positions such as EMTs, MAs, and NAs. I mean, that program you're doing is wonderful. In fact, my kid's in it. And that's wonderful that high schoolers are starting to take advantage of this. But these programs are all very similar. Wouldn't it be best to combine them all? I've sat in every one of these, but wouldn't it be best to combine all of them and use that same model you're doing with NAs around the whole state so we can really get entry-level people into these positions? I really applaud this effort, but has that ever been talked about in looking at the curriculum to kind of cater to that? I don't know who can take that.
Yeah, is that from Ms. Rydrick, maybe? Or Ms. Rydrick, can you try to address that one?
Yeah, I can. Thanks, Madam Chair and Representative Hewitt. And I'm really glad to hear that your son is in an NA program. That's fantastic. You know, it is a great initiative, and we're already kind of trying to look beyond that to where the next 1,000 CNA is going to come from. And I would say, you know, a lot of the energy right now has been around long-term care and supporting long-term care and hospitals, and really recognizing the significant challenges that they're having with nursing assistants. And it hasn't been so much on EMTs, but and other professions of that ilk. I do think, though, where I've heard some discussion around there that's promising is, could we look at what are some of the common skills that are needed across multiple professions, and whether there's kind of a training core that you could put in place where if someone completes certain modules that prepares them for a range of options a little bit farther down the line? And can we think about our health professions education in that way? So we're thinking about what are the common skills and what are the sort of ladders that are a possibility for someone once they've developed those basic skills. So I think there's a lot that could be explored there, even if it hasn't been a focus of some of these current investments.
Thank you. And you know what, if I could just inject a bit here, I think we might have, just for the benefit of people listening, I don't know if we hadn't really been talking about that 1,000-person training program before Representative Hewitt asked the question. And I just, Ms. Rydrick, just for the information of anybody who's listening who might find that little discussion out of context, could you just kind of frame up what we're talking about here so people will know?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Madam Chair, although I for any level of detail, I highly recommend Commissioner Olson from the Office of Higher Ed, who's leading that effort. It is an effort to identify and train 1,000 new individuals into certified nursing assistant positions around the state. And so Commissioner Olson and his team, working together with the Long-Term Care Imperative, with Minsky and others, has been working to provide support to training programs to make sure that they have slots available and to secure and then implement funding that covers all the costs for individuals who go through those programs. So supplies, tuition costs, et cetera, to make it really free for them. And their goal is to complete that first 1,000 new CNAs very, very soon. I think the initial target was the end of January, and they're getting a lot of people through the training and now moving towards testing. I know that they are also starting to explore what are the best ways to connect those people to providers on the long-term care side and the hospital side who need employment, and what are the connections that they can make to those, for those people to jobs. So it's a really exciting initiative. And when we had county level meetings all around the state, we had school districts there, we had superintendents there, and they were ready and willing and excited to really push that opportunity for high schoolers, for college students, for mid-career people. It's a really exciting opportunity.
Great, thank you. Sorry to put you on the spot. I know this isn't your particular program, but thank you for that. I think it's really important to have that context. Okay, next we have Representative Grunhagen, then Pryor, then Quam. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. And I do agree, we have a shortage and crisis in hospitals and also the nursing home situation or assisted living. My question is, you know, I talked to a doctor in my district and also a registered nurse, and both of them had not been vaccinated. They both claimed they had natural immunity, and they were being threatened with termination because they weren't vaccinated. So I know there's a lawsuit out of Northfield, I think, and there's other doctors and RNs that were terminated because they refused the vaccine for whatever reason or weren't given a medical or a religious exemption. And to what degree, and either one of you can answer this, did the terminations of existing healthcare staff over this vaccine controversy contribute to our current crisis? Do you have a number of how many were terminated? You know, we called them heroes for about an hour and a half, or a year and a half to 2 years, and now they're giving the boot out the door. So it does seem a little contradictory, but do you have a total number that were let go for that, for the vaccine controversy?
I'm not sure if this would be partly, maybe Ms. Rydrick has some of the data on this. I think it's actually a rather small percentage, but Ms. Rydrick?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, thank you for the question. We do not collect this information in any systematic way. So the information that we do have about the extent to which any providers have let people go related to their vaccine policies, if those individuals were not able to get a medical or religious exemption, it really is, we're hearing it from the same source as you are, which is we've heard testimony from a number of the large systems in the Senate, I think, and most of them indicated that the number of individuals who they had let go related to the mandate was low, in the double digits for very large health systems. I think if you wanted to get more information on that, you'd probably need to go to them directly and find out how many people they have let go. We've been doing a lot of work on the long-term care side to understand the impact of the mandate and really doing outreach to nursing homes about that. And we've been comforted, I think, to hear that most of them are feeling good about their ability to weather this. It's a challenge for them, especially in areas of the state where vaccination rates are lower. But we've been surveying them. We've been working with them to understand how many of their staff they think they might lose and to offer them support to help them get through that, whether it's helping people get vaccinated and helping them understand the benefits of vaccination or helping them get access to other resources. And we've been hearing really, I won't say they feel good about where they're at with staffing right now, but they feel like they're getting through this and kind of getting over the hump and getting past the challenges of the mandate. So that's been really reassuring.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, follow up?
Yeah, just a quick follow up. Hey, thanks for that response. And I would just say it seems that when we have a crisis and staff shortage, to let qualified people go out the door and replace them with people who aren't experienced does seem a little bit of a contradiction. And I think it...
Representative Gernhagen, you're talking about, first of all, federal law that requires these employees to be vaccinated, because that mandate was not overturned. So there is a federal mandate. So really, this isn't, you know, editorializing it about it here isn't really that useful and a little bit off topic, but here, finish your thought and then let's move on because we have a couple other questions and we do have another presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My point is, I think it would be good if the department and the commissioners encouraged medical facilities to apply as liberal as possible religious and medical exemptions rather than seeing the termination of these qualified individuals at a time where we called them heroes for about a year and a half to 2 years, and now they have to leave their profession. Thank you.
Well, Representative Gernhagen, you know, I just want to respond to that briefly. First of all, I don't think that's really their job. But the other piece of that is I remember at the beginning of the pandemic when there was a lot of concern about the spread of COVID in nursing facilities, and a lot of people got sick and died. And one thing we do know about this virus is that people who are older are most vulnerable to it, get the sickest and more frequently die. And so for my money, making sure that people who are actually giving them care are vaccinated is a very, very smart policy. And was if it was my mother or me or somebody else, somebody that I care about, I certainly would want to make sure that the caregiver was vaccinated. So, I mean, we're not going to have this debate today, but since you brought it up, I think it's important to know that. So, Representative Pryor, you are next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, I was off mute and my phone rang, and I apologize that if that interrupted other people. I do appreciate your words on the importance of vaccination for keeping our vulnerable population safe and also keeping people on the job. But going back to the topic, which is really kind of this big overview of where we stand now on staffing shortage. I appreciate the presentation. And I was particularly interested in the third slide that you had from Ms. Rydrick. If I can address the question to you and as I understood this slide, it was showing kind of like some of the support staff in medical care versus the physicians and nurses, and how that second group of people, the shortages or the staffing gap was the line that really was steeply increased. And I think, you know, in terms of long-term policy, I was interested in thinking and hearing more about that, because I know some of our support staff, you know, the training can be done quickly, and that we can, if we put out incentives, we can quickly, more quickly add to our staff in those different areas. But if we're talking about physicians, if we're talking about nurses and the years of training that go into that, we have to look several years into the future to really have an impact on that. So I was hoping you could make more comments on that. First of all, if my understanding of that was correct, you know, more or less correct. And if you could also talk about kind of like the lead time, if we're gonna set up policies when we can expect to see some kind of the results if there is a way to incentivize more people to go into these fields. So thank you.
Ms. Rydrick.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Pryor. So I'm not sure which slide it was, if it was the one showing the vacancy rates or the one showing the map, because on my deck, the number three is the map. But I think I can answer your question either way.
Though, she means the two lines.
The two lines, yeah. And
thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a good point, and that's why I wanted to note that in the budget proposal that we that the governor has put forward for revitalizing the healthcare workforce, we really are looking kind of along that whole continuum and that pipeline. I think it's important to think about what we can do when people are already employed, whether that's loan forgiveness or stipends or retention bonuses or hero pay or whatever it is. But we also have to look farther upstream and look at that clinical training pipeline, look at what we're doing to encourage people to get into the healthcare workforce in the first place, like the 1000 CNA initiative and getting people when they're in high school and exposing them to these careers and getting them interested in it. Because you're right. I mean, if our need is for physicians right now, we're not going to snap our fingers and suddenly have a lot more physicians. But what we tried to do with the proposal around revitalizing the workforce is really look at it more comprehensively. So on the physician side too, that's where I think the IMG program comes in. We have immigrant medical graduates who are licensed to practice in their home countries who are unable to practice here. And how do we really make use of that resource as well and see how we can get people into areas where they are needed to provide care? So it's important to look at all points along that continuum.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Pryor? Okay, very good. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because of the pandemic, a lot of double occupancy rooms became single occupancy. Do we have data showing the impact on total beds, also the impact on staffing? Not sure if you have a ward and they're all singles or if you've got double the staffing you'd require and the differences that. So we can understand as we stage back out of the more isolated care that we've sort of moved into to more of the normal, how that might impact the staffing needs.
Ms. Rydrick.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Quam, that's a great question, and one that I will have to take back to our data team. We have seen situations where double occupancy rooms have converted to single. We have also seen situations where hospitals are converting spaces or beds to be able to provide more care beyond what they would otherwise, converting observation beds or converting a wing that they hadn't been using before to add beds. I don't have numbers offhand for how those changes have kind of played out in terms of staffed beds over the course of the pandemic. So I would have to take that back. I suspect that our data that we have right now on available beds and staff beds is much better and much more frequent than what we had pre-pandemic because we've been looking at it every day. But I'll see what we can pull together to help answer that. I think it's a great question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
I think as a committee, we might want to look at going forward, there may be a different mix of private rooms, isolation, et cetera, and that we may have to look at the, we're allowing this hospital to have X number of beds and et cetera. We may have to revisit, in fact, it's probably good every few years to revisit that allocation and the, quota or limit number and et cetera. But I think that would be a great time to have some of this additional information that we've gained over the last couple of years. We're looking at different staffing. Now we should look at that part of law and improve it. And my last thing is that the chair is very familiar with some of the educational cooperative efforts in the Rochester and Olmsted area for senior high school through junior college and those age groups for training And plus, I believe a few of them have a very high outreach percentage. And that probably would be nice to have that reference information available to the committee members just when we're talking about new programs. We have some examples of programs that might be cross-pollinated in other parts of the state. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. All right. Thank you so much, Commissioner Harpstead and Acting Assistant Commissioner Rydrick and Ms. Huntley. Really appreciate your presentations to us today. And so we're going to move on now to Dr. Chamolo, who has a really interesting report to discuss with us today. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And thank you, committee, for having me to go over our reports that we just released. So for those who aren't familiar, I'm Nathan Chamolo, a pediatrician and internist, and serve as the Medicaid medical director for DHS. And so I'm here today to talk about our report, Building Racial Equity into the Walls of Minnesota Medicaid, a focus on U.S.-born Black Minnesotans, a report that's been in the works for over a year now. Whenever I enter into these conversations, I think it's important to do our role to recognize the role of past trauma and abuse. And so the state of Minnesota, the Department of Human Services, recognize the trauma, medical abuse, and discrimination that have happened to our Black, Indigenous, and other communities of color, those who live with disabilities and identify as LGBTQ+, that leads and contributes to the distrust in medicine and social service providers, that contributes to the inequities that we see. And so the work of equity and anti-racism require that we're all actively committed to rebuilding that trust with community and considering the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together here today. So it's also always helpful when entering these conversations to have some grounding definitions. And so when we talk about racism, I refer to the definition that Dr. Kamara Jones, a physician, PhD epidemiologist, and former president of the American Public Health Association, uses. Dr. Jones has been talking about the impact on health of racism for over 20 years. And she defines racism as a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on the social interpretation of how one looks, which is what we call race, that unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities, unfairly advantages other individuals and communities, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. Similarly, it's helpful to have some definitions when we say anti-racism and anti-racist policy. And so my colleague, Dr. Karen McKinney, and her colleague from Bethel, Professor Essenberg, define anti-racism as a personal and collective identity, which embraces the intentional dismantling of our racialized society and proactively builds racial peace. And then anti-racist policy, as defined by Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, is any measure that produces or sustains racial equity between racial groups. And so Harvard science historian Evelyn Hammond's clear and direct reflection on the legacy of our healthcare system really sets the frame in this report, noting that there's never been any period in American history where the health of Blacks was equal to that of whites. Disparity is built into the system. And we also reflect on the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who noted, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and the most inhuman." This, of course, is not news to many in our communities in Minnesota. Dr. Samuel Myers from the University of Minnesota coined the term Minnesota paradox to describe how Minnesota can have one of the highest qualities of life for white Minnesotans, depicted by this famous Time cover of Governor Wendell Anderson, while African Americans are worse off in Minnesota than they are virtually in every other state in the nation, noting that when you look beneath the surface of our high rankings, often when we look at different communities, the outcomes are starkly different, particularly for Black Minnesotans. We know that disparities aren't just in health, and that population level disparities don't happen by chance. They are derived from inequities. And so for Black Minnesotans, the consistent denial to the same opportunities for housing, education, nutrition, healthy neighborhoods, and justice under law makes the resultant health disparities they experience less surprising. And as depicted on the right, U.S.-born Black Minnesotans are predominantly descended from individuals and communities subjected to chattel slavery, Jim Crow segregation, mass incarceration and police violence, disadvantaged neighborhoods, less wealth, and less opportunity, which has all been shown to lead to chronic intergenerational stress. And these features of structural racism directly contribute to the racial health disparities we see today. And so while all racially minoritized communities in Minnesota experience some degree of health disparity in one or more chronic conditions, we note that U.S.-born Black Minnesotans notably have amongst the worst outcomes, both amongst adults and children. And so when examining how we got here, it's important then to internalize this distinction when we talk about inequity and disparity, inequity being an instance or injustice, and disparity being the noticeable and usually significant difference. And structural racism is therefore the inequity that leads to racial disparities. This report then builds off of work already done around equity and DHS more broadly with the institution of our equity policy in 2017, which emphasizes our commitment to advancing equity, reducing disparities in DHS program outcomes, and improving access to human services for all communities experiencing inequities. This policy's foundation was in the health in all policies approach from MDH, with the goal of having a human-centered design framework that considers health beyond the absence of disease, but to a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being. And within the Medicaid agency, within DHS, we've been using a racial equity assessment tool to help guide that commitment to equity. To really utilize racial equity assessments, however, we have had to have a different understanding of how investments in and cuts to our programs and policies impact different communities in Minnesota disproportionately. And so to get that fuller picture, I worked with Lynn Blewett and Elizabeth Lukinen from SHADAC to look at the data on how Minnesotans access health and get their healthcare insurance. And on the left, you can see data from 2018, which shows that in 2018, roughly 60% of Minnesotans received their insurance through employer-sponsored insurance, with roughly 14% receiving their insurance through Medicaid. But when you look at Minnesotans by racial community, we see a little different picture when we look and we find that in 2019, 41.5% of Black Minnesotans received their medical care through Medicaid versus 39% of American Indian Minnesotans, 29.5% of Hispanic Minnesotans, 20% of Asian Minnesotans, and 9% of white Minnesotans. So again, showing the disproportionate impact of investments in and cuts to Medicaid. This is even more notable for children in Minnesota. So when you look at those underneath the age of 18, 64% of Black Minnesota children receive their healthcare access through Medicaid, 54% of American Indian children, 52% of Hispanic Latino children, 31% of Asian children, and 17% of white children. So it's quite clear that Minnesota has some of the worst racial inequities and some of the worst racial health disparities, and Black Minnesotans are disproportionately covered by Minnesota Medicaid. And so really it is upon us in Minnesota Medicaid to focus on racial equity. And focusing just on Black Minnesotans, however, doesn't tell a whole story. MDH had a report in 2019 on culturally relevant care, and they noted that the data often masks disparities impacting U.S.-born Black community members, in some part due to a healthy immigrant effect, a well-known phenomenon where immigrants are on average healthier than those who were born in the U.S. And so in the report, we provide this table compiled by Dr. Justine Nelson at DHS, which shows the notable health disparities between U.S.-born Black and African enrollees on our Medicaid programs compared with those who immigrated to the U.S. And although the average age of enrollees in the two groups was the same, U.S.-born Black and African-American Minnesotans had higher rates in every adverse outcome than those who immigrated to the United States. And between these groups, rates of asthma, heart failure, hospitalized heart conditions, and depression were three times higher for U.S.-born Black Minnesotans. And overall, U.S.-born Black Minnesotans had the highest prevalence of asthma, hypertension, and heart failure of any group, and the second or third highest of many other medical or behavioral health conditions. And this healthy immigrant effect has been seen by researchers in the US, Canada, and Europe, with literature generally noting a couple of reasons. Immigrants can have a healthier lifestyle than people born here, in part due to structural racism and inequity that US-born communities face. And there are studies which find a selection bias via immigration. And that's to say that immigrants are generally also healthier than the people in the country they left. And so to arrive here is somewhat of a selection bias. So given the distinct current and historical contexts that have contributed to the health of Black communities in the United States, and in order to focus on specific community strengths and the opportunities to build racial equity from their perspective, this report focuses on US-born Black communities. It also aims to continue the evolution of how policy within Minnesota Department of Human Services is designed, proposed, and considered by intentionally striving for community co-creation. Our goal with this report is to engage at the level of INVOLVE, per the International Association for Public Participation's spectrum. And so that means to work directly with the public throughout the process to ensure that public concerns and aspirations are consistently understood and considered. And our promise is to work to ensure their concerns and aspirations are directly reflected in the proposals and alternatives developed and provide feedback on how public input influenced the decision. It's also important to note when we talk about community that neither the Black immigrant nor US-born communities are monolithic. The experiences of Black Minnesotans can and do vary by their geography, income, sexual orientation, gender identity, and the other communities and beliefs they identify with. However, the impact of structural racism is felt by all to some degree, and this is what guides the focus of this report. So to start to meet that at the onset, we had conversations with Black Minnesota community leaders, members, and those working to improve racial equity in healthcare for Black Minnesotans about the scope and goals of this report and framed it through four levers by which we as a Medicaid agency could really continue to act: eligibility and enrollment, access, quality, and early opportunities. And then from there, we had discussions with DHS staff working in the areas of policy identified by our conversations with community members, and shared some of the reflections provided and asked for help in thinking through what ideas could be operationalized and what it would take. And then those conversations informed draft calls to action, which were shared during two public community conversations where the team sought further guidance from community members through facilitated discussion. In the box there, you can see the lived experiences of the individuals who participated in those community conversations. And then these discussions, reflections, and recommendations from these conversations have all been incorporated into the report. And so I'll take you through how we talked about the different levers here. So the first lever being eligibility and enrollment. And so thinking about who is eligible for Medicaid, what is the process for enrollment, for re-enrollment, and how does someone get and keep their Medicaid insurance in the first place? As you see from this data from 2019 from the Minnesota Department of Health, despite being eligible for Medicaid, many people who would benefit from Medicaid coverage aren't enrolled at all or experience gaps in their coverage, with this data showing 49% of uninsured individuals in Minnesota estimated to be eligible for public health insurance programs like Medicaid. And then surveys have found, looking across the country, that the experience of income volatility differed by the race and ethnicity of communities, with 45% of Hispanic households, 38% of Black households, and 32% of White households reporting some degree of income volatility. And another study looking at Medicaid enrollees nationally noted that Black Medicaid enrollees were more likely than white enrollees to go off Medicaid for more than 6 months. And those who were off more than 6 months were less likely than those who stayed on to have a regular source of care, more likely to forego health care for financial reasons, and more likely to report problems paying medical bills. The second lever looking at is access, which refers to enrollees' ability, once they have been determined eligible and enrolled, to access care. Is there a primary care provider within a reasonable distance from their home? Do they have access to culturally relevant care that is delivered with humility? Do they have reasonable access to specialists, behavioral health care, or dentistry? And there's ample evidence that access is a significant barrier for Medicaid enrollees. This is on the left there, you see data from a 2017 analysis of a 2008 survey that showed that enrollees on Minnesota Medicaid reported 55%, I should say, of enrollees reported some access barriers, and 49% of enrollees reported experiencing some discrimination described as unfair treatment due to gender, ability to pay, enrollment in Medicaid, or race, ethnicity, or nationality. And as you can see from our Minnesota DHS 2021 Medicaid Consumer Satisfaction Survey, and so this is the survey that goes out to managed care enrollees about different aspects of their care, Black respondents were statistically significantly more likely to be told they showed up too late to an appointment to still be seen. And we added this question to have a proxy for missed opportunities for care. If someone overcame all their transportation barriers and showed up to clinic, were they still told that they couldn't be seen because they were too late? And what we saw there is 95% of white respondents were replied that they were never told they were too late to be seen versus 84% of Black respondents. And also with access, it's important to note that given that nearly 80% of Medicaid enrollees are served by a managed care organization, it's important that we work with, measure, and incentivize managed care organizations' efforts to improve racial equity and access to care. The third lever is quality. And so once an enrollee successfully gets access to care, do they receive care at the same level of quality as other Medicaid members or other Minnesotans? Are the measures we use to define quality consistent with what the community would define as quality care? And so as you can see here from the Minnesota Community Measurements 2020 Annual Minnesota Healthcare Disparities by Insurance Report, and we just took one measure, colorectal cancer screening rates, it's been noted for more than a decade that enrollees in Medicaid managed care have significantly lower rates in common healthcare quality measures across the board compared to other payers. And we see this across multiple measurement rates. And we also see a gap within a gap or a disparity within a disparity. So Medicaid enrollees have lower rates than those who are privately insured. And amongst Medicaid enrollees, Black and African American members consistently experience even lower rates on a majority of measures than other groups of enrollees. And last year, Minnesota Community Measurement put out a report on healthcare disparities by race, Hispanic ethnicity, language, and country of origin. And they found that Black patients whose preferred language is English have significantly lower rates of optimal diabetes care, optimal vascular care, and depression remission at 6 months compared to Black patients whose primary language is not English. As you can see on the left here, this is looking specifically at optimal diabetes care, where you see amongst English-speaking Black patients, 33.8% had optimal care versus 41.6% of non-English-speaking. And you look at patients born in the U.S., 30.3% had optimal diabetes care versus 42% for those born outside the U.S. So this speaks to additional barriers U.S.-born Black Minnesotans may face receiving the same level of quality care in Minnesota. The last lever looked at early opportunities. Medicaid disproportionately covers pregnant people and children. And knowing the long-term impact of the first years of a child's life, how can Medicaid ensure health and racial equity from the very start? So on the left, we note that MA covers roughly 4 in 10 births in Minnesota. But when we look amongst birthing persons who identify as Black, that is 8 in 10 births in Minnesota. And so the environment and level of support children are raised in during their first 5 years, we know is critical to reaching their full potential. And early experiences shape brain development in a way that impacts not only education and school readiness, but lifelong health. And again, we highlight that in Minnesota, 64% of Black children are covered by Medicaid. And so focusing on how we explicitly build racial equity into eligibility, enrollment, access, and quality for our mothers and youngest Minnesotans and fathers is critical. A failure to address racial equity in maternal and early childhood policy will set the health and opportunities presented to Black children on a different trajectory and make the state's commitment to equity that much more difficult to achieve. So to recap, using those levers as a way to frame the opportunity for action, we again met with and aligned the input received from these initial meetings with community collaborators with our policy areas, and then came back and discussed this with communities and our calls to action. And again, this is all incorporated into this report. This iterative process resulted in calls to action for three Medicaid policies and programs that were most commonly cited by the U.S.-born Black Minnesota community members that the report team engaged with. We did find it important to highlight that none of these calls to action seek to create Medicaid-funded services that are racially exclusive. Instead, we recognize the long overdue need to ensure policies, programs, and the administration of each are done with awareness and action towards racial equity. And so we frame these different opportunities with several questions. Why does the problem exist? What has Medicaid done to address it? And finally, what has the community realized or brought to our attention as the issue? And what are the calls to action that are needed right now to build racial equity into the walls of our Medicaid program? So the first call to action is around simplifying and supporting enrollment and renewal. So again, thinking who is eligible. U.S.-born Black Minnesotans enrolled in Medicaid programs often talk about challenges they face in enrolling in Minnesota healthcare programs. We know nationally, nearly one in four Medicaid enrollees have had to change coverage within 1 year prior to the pandemic, and a majority experience gaps in coverage, which has been attributed to how frequently states require enrollees to renew or re-verify their eligibility, the amount of time states provide enrollees to respond to renewal or re-verifications, and the income fluctuation among populations covered by Medicaid. This is often termed churn. So one of the ways DHS has tried to support people applying for Medicaid is to ensure that community navigators stay in business during the COVID-19 pandemic. Several of the steps that we took to help Minnesotans maintain healthcare coverage during the public health emergency resulted in a steep decline in the number of new applications and suspended virtually all renewal activities, which caused a decrease in navigator incentive payments. And so DHS worked with the legislature to move some of those unused incentive payment funds as grants to help support navigators during the pandemic. DHS has also been planning to make the Medicaid application process simpler by allowing people to apply using the online portal and phone app called Minnesota Benefits, which hopefully you're all aware of, a tool recently launched, which allows Minnesotans to simultaneously apply for programs such as SNAP, MFIP, emergency assistance, housing support, and childcare support. And having this tool allow people to also apply for Medicaid at the same time would be a great step towards better accessibility, and we're in the planning phase of that work. And then improving Medicaid enrollment and renewal policies for justice-involved populations provides another step in improving racial equity. It was noted in 2015 that Black Minnesotans are incarcerated 9 times more than white Minnesotans. And while research shows that this disparity in incarceration rates contributes to racial health disparities, it also points to how increased access to care may lead to improved outcomes. Minnesota has traditionally terminated people's Medicaid coverage upon incarceration, which requires them to reapply for Medicaid when they are about to be released. During the COVID-19 emergency, DHS put in place a procedure to ensure that Medicaid enrollees remain enrolled in Medicaid without interruption, creating a special code to ensure that Medicaid funds only inpatient hospitalization. Under this new policy and procedure, Medicaid enrollees remain enrolled during incarceration and have full coverage restored upon release. And we're currently working to make those changes permanent in all Medicaid eligibility systems. However, the community, you know, shared that the process remains very confusing and complicated, that the communication on the status of their applications is poor, and really a desire to think through how we can keep people enrolled who are eligible. And you can see some of the quotes from different surveys over the last several years that touch on these points. Multiple sources have suggested the value of having navigators to help people apply for coverage through the MNSURE portal, particularly for people without a computer or internet access at home. One study by the Improve Group in 2016 found that participants who received help applying for coverage from MNSURE navigators reported a far better experience and fewer challenges in getting started with MA than those who did not. So based on that understanding of this lever and our conversations with community and DHS staff, our first call to action is that DHS should improve racial equity and eligibility enrollment and renewal by pursuing continuous eligibility policies. These are also referred to as continuous enrollment and allows enrollees to maintain their enrollment regardless of changes in circumstances. A 12-month continuous eligibility for children is a longstanding retention strategy for states with 32 states already offering this. They do this through the authority from the Social Security Act, which grants states the option to provide continuous eligibility to children under 19 for up to 12 months. Minnesota doesn't have yet this yet. And we do note in the report that it is part of the federal Build Back Better Act that is in the Senate right now. But we note that even if that doesn't pass, it is really crucial that we move forward here in Minnesota as a way to, again, build racial equity. And we highlighted that it is included in Governor Tim Walz's budget proposal as well. We also believe DHS could go a step further and pursue additional expansion of continuous eligibility, given what is known about the importance of the first 5 years on early brain development and what has occurred in the past 2 years where we've essentially had continuous eligibility and enrollment during the COVID-19 pandemic. DHS should explore an 1115 Medicaid demonstration waiver to implement 72 months of continuous eligibility for children on Medicaid up to age 6. And establish 24 months of continuous eligibility for all enrollees age 6 and older. We note that both of these changes have recently been proposed by Oregon's Medicaid agency in their Medicaid demonstration waiver proposal. Our second piece of call to action around eligibility enrollment and renewal is to support navigators and simplify the enrollment and renewal process. And so working with navigators and the U.S. born Black community to develop a plan that is focused on ensuring eligible Black Minnesotans gain or maintain Medicaid coverage throughout the year, but in particular as the federal public health emergency ends. After each set of calls to action, we have these call-out boxes, which really try to recognize that changes in Medicaid policy can require state or federal legislative authority or funding. And so how can we really place accountability on DHS to the extent that is possible? And also recognizing that these are just some of the ways to improve racial equity for U.S.-born Black Minnesotans based on this iterative process. There are many actions that can realize racial equity, and the process is important, but accountability ultimately comes from a change in outcomes. And so when we talk about outcomes for eligibility, enrollment, and renewal, it would be minimal disparity in the percent of U.S.-born Black Minnesotans who maintain coverage at the end of the federal public health emergency compared to average Medicaid enrollees. The second call to action is around access to culturally relevant care. There's ample evidence that access is a significant barrier for Black community members. A national 2018 AHRQ survey found that 12% of Black adults who had a doctor's office or clinic visit in the last 12 months and needed care, tests, or treatment, sometimes or never found it easy to get the care, tests, or treatment, compared with only 6% of white adults. We also know there's barriers to being able to be seen by providers that share your background and culture. You see there that although Black residents make up roughly 7% of the general population, only roughly 2.5% of Minnesota physicians and 1% of physician assistants identified as Black or African American in 2019. This is important because we know that racial concordance and cultural concordance do impact outcomes, and that one of those is on cultural competency. And again, if we look at MDH's 2019 report on culturally responsive care, they note that cultural competency is critical to providing equitable, effective, and respectful care and services, and includes but is not limited to being responsive to diverse beliefs and values related to health and well-being, delivering services in preferred languages, and being mindful of health literacy and numeracy.
Dr. Chumlo, excuse me for interrupting. I just want to let you know that we only have about 12 minutes left in the hearing. So just want you to be able to pace yourself, and we do have at least one question.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So when we think about what the community brought to us as far as what community members shared, they really note that culture is missing. Community leaders stress the importance of culture and health and well-being of community members. And culture is described as the fabric that links an individual to their community through shared beliefs, knowledge, practices, and protections, and that loss of culture in the healing space contributes to illness by separating an individual from one of their shared strengths. DHS has tried to improve culturally relevant care by services like doulas and community health workers, as well as models of care like our Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancies program. And so the recommendation to address culturally relevant care is to invest in an internal structure that has a specific focus on U.S.-born Black Minnesotans. To address generations of structural inequity will require sustained intention, and so a dedicated internal structure could provide a direct connection to U.S.-born Black Medicaid enrollees, community-based organizations, and other institutions to inform and co-create policies and programs, as well as ensuring efforts throughout DHS and other state agencies like the Department of Health are all leveraging available funding resources to close gaps seen in health outcomes. And there's some precedent for this approach. DHS did launch in 2020 the African American Child Wellbeing Unit to help address structural racism in the child welfare system. Additionally, continuing to prioritize standardization and disaggregation of race, ethnicity, and language data is a call to action. While an incomplete and imperfect proxy for culture, race, ethnicity, and language data can serve as an important initial signal and inform conversation and collaboration with communities. One community conversation participant noted a need to proactively identify data. There's not enough data, and the way we collect data is not moving at the same speed as how diversity is increasing. And many of the reflections and solutions proposed by participants in our community conversations would rely on some points of precise race, ethnicity, and language data. And so thinking again about our accountability and what the outcome would be increase in the number of and utilization of culturally specific providers. The last calls to action was around engaging the communities and families Medicaid serves. In all our discussions, both with community members and DHS staff, there's a shared desire for meaningful engagement and co-creation. And historically, that engagement has been with enrollees from multiple groups. And we know that top-down policy solutions have been tried for at least a generation, and yet disparities continue to grow. So meaningful solutions really must be found in consultation and partnership with communities. And really, the communities shared a need for that culturally specific consultation and for ongoing longitudinal engagement, where you can find ways to share both co-creation and power. DHS has tried to have some focused areas on community engagement, but has not yet instituted true longitudinal engagement with specific communities. And so our call to action is funding community conversations with US One. Yeah. Hi, buddy. Sorry.
Look, I got my new brain today.
I'm thanks. So sorry about that. My coworker has a new slinky. So DHS should integrate not just community engagement in general, but longitudinal culturally specific engagement of enrollees and their families into routine policy, budget, and administrative activities. And again, that outcome being sufficient funding for longitudinal, authentic community conversations. And so we end the report by reflecting on this moment for change. And we do note that on his first full day in office, President Biden issued an executive order establishing a presidential COVID-19 health equity task force, charging them with recommending actions against longstanding and emerging health inequities exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. So that task force met over 10 months, hundreds of working sessions, extensive literature reviews, more than 100 subject matter experts that they talked to, and 8 public meetings, and they came up with 55 recommendations and 5 actions proposed as overarching priorities that you can see here. And given the incredibly broad scope of the task force, it is notable that all 5 of the proposed priorities are reflected in some way in our report's calls to action to build racial equity in the walls of Medicaid for U.S.-born Black Minnesotans, which we believe gives further credence to choosing to focus on a historically under-resourced community is vital to authentically addressing racial health inequities for all. And so the calls to action detailed and justified in this report serve as a guide to prioritize actions, but also overlap with the needs for other historically under-resourced communities. And the iterative process established in developing this report as recommendations and the subsequent accountability for action also aim to set the expectation for other work within DHS, including reports on building racial and health equity into Medicaid for Native and Indigenous Minnesotans, Hispanic, Latinx Minnesotans, Asian Pacific Islander Minnesotans, new Minnesotans or immigrants, Minnesotans who identify as LGBTQ+, live with disabilities, are unhoused or incarcerated. And we finished by saying, you know, what might surprise readers of this report is most of this is not revolutionary. W.B. Du Bois over 100 years ago was pointing out the impact of structural racism and how social drivers of health impacted the opportunity of Black Americans. And the solutions he proposed then echo throughout this report. And we cited the need to meet this moment based off of another piece of advice Dr. Du Bois, or W.B. Du Bois shared in his book, The Souls of Black Folk, that now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It's today that our best work can be done and not some future day or future year. I want to share, you know, a big thanks with everyone who went in, put in work to making this report come to life. My co-writers at DHS, those who helped with technical assistance of the report, our community collaborators who met with us from the very beginning, and those who helped facilitate the community conversations we had. And so you can find the report online, and then we do have an email set up for feedback. And we also are hoping to launch, after gauging interest internally and from the community, several work groups to tackle each of our calls to action moving forward. But at this time, I will stop for any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chumlo. That is really very thorough and very eye-opening. And, you know, when I especially was intrigued by the language about building equity into the walls of Minnesota Medicaid. That's a really a great image, building equity into the walls. So I had seen Representative Quam with his hand up. I'm not seeing him right now. Maybe if we could, there we go. Representative Quam, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I noticed several locations amongst the data in the presentation where there's some correlated improvements, some of them quite noticeable. During the period of historic low unemployment pre-pandemic, and it might be nice to get some data of how that impacts the disparities, employment versus unemployment. But I'm more interested in, was there any look at the genomic aspect? In other words, some medications work for a portion of the population and don't work for others. And by increasing that information, study and data, delivering the right medication, what impact that has to improving healthcare outcomes and disparities?
Yeah, so
Dr. Chumlo.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Thanks, Madam Chair. So thank you for the question, Representative Quam. So you're referring to the pharmacogenomics and the idea that there might be some aspects of genetics that make some medications more impactful than others. And that's independent from our discussion about racial inequity, because race is not a biological factor, it's a social factor. So you cannot tell my genetics solely on my race. In fact, if I told you what my ethnic heritage was, I don't think you would believe it. So I think that is certainly an area of interest and as we look to seek more effective, cost-effective therapies, but it does not pertain to how we address racial inequity or racial disparities.
Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. There are documented things where Native Hawaiians, the predominant medication for a major procedure, used after a major procedure, have no effect because they can't metabolize it. There are many indications, but the idea is some people and populations in our state, we don't have the best or sufficient data to be able to assist in getting the right medication. And most of the newer medications, they have some of the pharmacogenomic data taken so you can avoid, a bad complication, but also you get the most effective. And I think that would behoove anyone looking at healthcare disparities to try to see if we can expand that knowledge and assistance.
Okay, Representative Quam, I'm going to move on to Representative Morrison because we're just about out of time here.
I don't like when a testifier totally ignores.
I think he answered your question, Representative Quam.
Not very well.
We're
going to
move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sure he'll be happy to talk with you more offline. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really just wanted to thank Dr. Chalmala for just a really compelling and excellent and sobering presentation. I'm just really grateful for the work that you and DHS have done on this. You provided an important history lesson and really laid out a great call to action for all of us in Minnesota. I look forward to the day when the Minnesota paradox doesn't exist and every Minnesotan has the opportunity to be healthy and thrive. And I just want to thank you for your work.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I too want to thank you, Dr. Chalmala. We're so grateful to have you as part of our team and helping us to really do better as a state. And I think this is a moment. This is really a moment that we have some opportunities to make really big gains that are going to be important for all Minnesotans going forward. So thank you so much for being here today and for your report. And with that, members, it is 4:30. So thank you for your attendance today, and we are adjourned.